Good morning, everybody, and welcome to this morning's breakout session on new energy and the climate change debate. A nice double entendre there. My name is Jerry Orstrom. I'm a friend of the Philanthropy Roundtable and of our distinguished panelists here. That's about the only qualification that I have for being up here. I have no particular expertise in this issue. That's the good news, because you won't be hearing much from me. You'll be hearing from our panelists. And we're going to try to preserve a lot of time to hear from you all as well during the Q&A period. Each of our panelists are going to speak for roughly 15 minutes. After that, we'll have some brief exchange amongst ourselves up here, and then we'll go to Q&A. The way that we're framing this discussion is not about climate change per se and whether it's happening or not, but more from the perspective of energy issues relating to climate change. What have we been doing for the past 20 years? What new strategies might exist to address it? What are the characteristics of successful innovations in that regard? And what areas merit continued research and development, whether from the government sector or the private sector? In doing so, we're going to touch on various aspects of energy, traditional fossil fuels, the recent phenomenon of shale gas, which you've been hearing a lot about, the role of nuclear energy, the development of so-called renewables and their viability and how they might be financed, and the respective roles of government and the private sector within all of this. So before I briefly introduce our three panelists, I thought I'd go quickly to you guys for a quick poll of a couple of questions and see what you all think about a couple of aspects of this. With a show of hands, please, how many of you here believe that climate change is a sufficient problem to mandate some level of regulatory intervention? And how many believe that no such mandate is necessary, that it's not a sufficient problem? Looks roughly 2-1 for the latter. How many really don't have any idea? All right. I respect your humility. Second and last question, how many here believe that we must and that we can, that we have the capability, technically and otherwise, transition in a significant way from our so-called dependency on fossil fuels to renewables and other such new sources, perhaps within our lifetimes? How many believe that we can, should, and will achieve that? Not many of you. And how many believe that we really don't need to worry about that, and even if we did, it's probably not achievable and will be with fossil fuels for a rather indefinite period? How many? The majority. Okay. Thank you. With that, I'll do some brief introductions of our panelists. Ted Nordhaus, to my extreme left, will be going first. Ted is the founder and chairman of the Breakthrough Institute, which works at the nexus of climate, energy, and economic policy. Most notably, back in 2004, Ted co-authored a seminal and highly controversial essay called The Death of Environmentalism, and he was a pretty active environmentalist himself at the time, still is, truth be told, in a very positive sense. And Ted also authored the acclaimed Breakthrough, Why We Can't Leave Saving the Planet to Environmentalists. Among other things, in his remarks, Ted is going to focus on what kind of research needs to be done and how that research is going to be initiated and financed. One thing I like about Ted in the several years that I've known him is that I see his perspective constantly evolving. After Ted will go Ron Bailey, sitting in the middle. Ron, as many of you know, is an award-winning science correspondent with Reason Magazine. He's authored at least two books that I know of: Liberation Biology, The Moral and Scientific Case for the Biotech Revolution, and Eco-Scam, The False Prophets of Ecological Apocalypse. Ron has also edited numerous other books on energy and environment, and he has a perspective of having worked in his earlier years in government as a bureaucrat at the Federal Energy Commission, and I think he'll be telling us a couple of stories from that. Ron also has a distinction, if not somewhat ignominiously, of having attended the last 7 IPCC climate conferences And we'll hear a little bit about that. And Ron was also at the very first Earth Summit way back in 1992 in Rio. So he has a long-standing perspective on these issues. Finally, we'll hear from Robert Bryce. Robert is a senior fellow at the Center for Energy and Policy, Energy Policy and Environment at the Manhattan Institute. Robert has also authored several books, including Gusher of Lies, which is a terrific title, subtitled The Dangerous Delusions of Energy Independence. He's also written Pipe Dreams, another great title, subtitled Greed, Ego, and the Death of Enron. And he's also written a book called Power Hungry, The Myths of Green Energy and the Real Fuels for the Future. All three of our panelists have been published extensively in prominent periodicals and have made frequent television appearances. Finally, one thing that they all share, which I find most refreshing, is that among our three panelists, not one has a PhD or graduate degree. These guys have studied their fields from the ground up and not from some ivory tower. So with that, Ted, would you kick it off for us?
Well, thanks, Jerry, and it's great to be here at the roundtable. I'm going to take us through analysis and paper that we co-authored with a number of other scholars called Climate Pragmatism. Was released this last spring, kind of has gotten quite a lot of attention from folks who have sort of come to terms with the fact that the kind of contemporary effort to deal with climate change has failed and are trying to think about how we might find a different path towards dealing with the issue. I'm going to go through three things. The first, I'm going to talk briefly about climate science. I'm going to talk about why the current framework for dealing with climate change has failed, and then I'm going to sort of lay out a different path forward. So there is a huge debate about whether or not climate science is settled. And I would suggest to you that it's kind of an absurd debate, as if there were a single scientific question to settle, which there is not. There are multiple questions, some of which I will argue to you are settled, many of which are not. So let me briefly gloss that. So here are some things that are settled that we pretty well know. We know that atmospheric concentrations of CO2 have risen, and you see the chart here. These are the measurements at the Mauna Loa Observatory, monthly average carbon dioxide concentration rising. We also know that there is a theoretical relationship, just basic physics, between concentrations of CO2 in any atmosphere and higher global temperatures. And here you see Arrhenius's famous equation from the 19th century that fairly well demonstrated that. We know that global temperatures have risen fairly significantly over the last century. And we have fairly good reason to think that at least some proportion of that observed warming is almost certainly caused by humans. That, I would argue to you, is what's settled. So let's talk about what's not settled. First, how much of the observed warming is natural versus human-caused? There is a wide range, great uncertainty about exactly how much of what we've observed is, even though we know that some of it is human-caused, how much of it is human-caused. Second, how much human warming is the result of CO2 versus other human activities? For instance, non-CO2 greenhouse gases, and also non-greenhouse gases, land use changes. And there's significant evidence to suggest that as much as 40% of anthropogenic warming is a result of non-CO2 forcings. Third, temperature sensitivity. What is the temperature impact of a doubling of CO2 in the atmosphere from pre-industrial levels? Well, estimates range anywhere from about 1.5 degrees Celsius to 6 degrees Celsius. In terms of global average temperature, that is a huge amount of difference. At 1.5, probably not a big deal. At 6, probably a pretty big deal. If we have knew what the global average temperature change was going to be, what the resulting impacts, climate impacts at a regional and local scale, highly uncertain. What does that mean in any particular place in terms of weather, natural disasters, other impacts? And finally, there's the question of what the cost of mitigation or adaptation would be. What is the cost of inaction? What are the costs of adapting to things that we can adapt to? And what is the rate of technological innovation and change likely to be, and hence the future cost of reducing emissions? So in all of these things, huge uncertainty. And everything I'm going to talk about moving forward is really predicated on acknowledging that there is enormous uncertainty here. A couple of remarks or observations about the climate science wars. The first is that the climate science debate is not about science. Don't be confused about that. It is really the debates over climate science are proxies for a variety of political, ideological, and policy preferences. The second is that climate science, whatever we can definitively say about it, is not going to dictate climate policy. There's just too far off in the future, too many uncertainties. The policy will not be set by or driven by the science. And finally, that any politically sustainable action or effort to reduce the risks associated with climate change has got to be predicated on the reality of continuing scientific uncertainty, not on the conceit that there is scientific certainty about what is going to happen. So let's now move on to why the current climate policy framework has failed. Well, first, the costs and benefits associated with those policies are badly misaligned. So we have high mitigation costs for present generations, and here you see a comparison of low-carbon energy sources versus conventional fuels, and very highly uncertain benefits for future generations, who we have to acknowledge are likely to be far wealthier than current generations. So there at the bottom, you see a projection of global GDP from 2005 through 2100, very substantial, 2100, a world that is vastly wealthier. And the current framework basically asks present generations who are much poorer to pay to mitigate costs for future generations who, under even most sort of IPCC climate scenarios, will be much wealthier, far wealthier. Second, there's the problem of sort of empty promises. In fact, the entire current framework is predicated on long-term commitments from nations to reduce their emissions. The problem is that long-term targets made today or commitments made today can't constrain future policymakers. Furthermore, it's difficult to even track and verify what actual emissions are. And the combination of these two things lead to all sorts of incentives to game the system. Carbon offsets, over-allocation of permits, all sorts of price caps and off-ramps and other ways to try to reduce and limit the costs of reducing emissions. And so the result, as you see here, you see performance of European nations, which have all supposedly made binding commitments to reduce their emissions, and most of them have not done so, in fact, have seen their emissions rise significantly. Finally, there is what our senior fellow at the Breakthrough Institute, Roger Pelkey Sr., describes as the iron law of climate policy, which is basically that no political economy in the world is willing to raise energy prices enough to significantly reduce carbon emissions. And that is a function of really the fact that the issue is very low salience. It's a problem that's far off in the future. It's difficult to visualize. And growth kind of consistently trumps climate concern across virtually all political economies. So let's talk about the path forward. What would an alternative approach look like? Well, it would better align the costs and benefits of action in the present. It would focus on actionable policy and measures today rather than future targets and timetables for emissions reductions. It would focus on actions that have highly salient benefits right now and happen to have ancillary benefits for climate, things like energy access and security and increasing resilience to natural disasters. And it will focus on making clean energy cheap rather than trying to make dirty energy expensive. We focus on really, in the climate pragmatism paper, three major things, energy technology innovation, resilience to extreme weather, no regrets pollution reduction strategies. The first thing you need to know about energy innovation is, over the next four decades, global population going to go from 7 billion to somewhere between 9 and 10 billion people. Global GDP will roughly triple. Global energy use will increase over 200%. Even if we radically improve energy efficiency, we're still looking at probably a 140% increase in global energy use. In the interest of time, I'm going to go through this really fast, but this is what the IEA says it would take to cut carbon emissions in half by 2050. Take all that. Do it every year from now until 2050. That's what it would take to hit the IPCC's mid-century carbon goal. But putting climate aside, there's lots of reasons to want to do energy innovation, reducing our dependence on foreign oil. Every major recession since 1970 has been preceded by an oil price spike. We spend about $1.4 billion a day on imported oil. And the current technologies that we have that are low carbon and non-fossil based are just vastly more expensive. So you see current market price and you can see where those various technologies fit. And these numbers actually, for a variety of reasons that I think Robert will go through, probably understate the cost of many of these new technologies today. So we need energy that's clean, cheap, massively scalable. To do that, we need to invest in energy science and education. Right now, we spend vastly less on energy R&D than we do on many other sectors. Here's a comparison between energy and health, both public and private R&D. We need to overhaul the energy innovation system. We've proposed creating an analog to the National Institutes of Health, called the National Institutes of Energy, focusing on a very decentralized regional strategy to build essentially hubs where universities, research laboratories, venture capitalists, others come together to kind of really focus on the technical problems that get in the way of these technologies actually being truly commercializable. We need to reform energy subsidies. And we've proposed using a system much more modeled on military procurement to drive innovation and price declines in clean energy technology. This is actually how we got cheap microchips. Pentagon deploying on the very cutting edge of these technologies for many years. And finally, we propose internalizing the cost of energy modernization and innovation rather than trying to internalize the cost of pollution. We proposed a $4 to $6 per ton CO2 tax, which would raise about $30 billion a year, which is about what we spend on public investment in health R&D, on energy R&D. I know I'm running out of time here. I'll just mention, try to go through this very quickly. Right now, the International Framework on Climate Change attempts to differentiate between human-caused global warming, natural disasters and just natural disasters, which makes no sense. It's impossible to do. We should just focus on making societies more resilient to natural disasters, whatever the source. So consider, this is Haiti after its earthquake, 7.0 earthquake. Japan after the Fukushima earthquake. The Haiti earthquake killed about 300,000 people, was about 2,000 times less powerful than the Japan earthquake, which was devastating, but only killed about 20,000 people. So that's the power of resilient development to deal with natural disasters. Finally, we focus on no-regrets pollution reduction strategies. Right now, about 2 billion people around the world live in energy poverty, no access to modern energy. 2 million people every year die just for exposure to indoor air pollution from primitive cook stoves. That black carbon and soot that comes from those cook stoves also is accelerating the melt of glaciers and ice caps. And as opposed to the climate change cap-and-trade legislation, opponents, this is Inhofe and Boxer here, who, you know, you can't even get to talk to each other about something like cap-and-trade. Well, Inhofe and Boxer sponsored legislation to actually try to accelerate the transition from primitive cook stoves and deal with black carbon. So here's an opportunity for some bipartisan action that has real immediate benefits for people all over the world and has climate benefits as an ancillary benefit. So my time's up.
Thank you, Ted. Boy, I must say that anything that can bring Imhoff and Boxer together can't be all bad. Or maybe it's terrible. Incidentally, on the Haiti and Japan earthquake contrast, another example there, of course, is Chile, which I think is also much larger than the Haitian earthquake, with far fewer consequences.
And actually, almost exactly the same magnitude.
Okay.
I think. Now, maybe I'm wrong about that. Anyway, your point.
I had no idea that we owed the microchip to Uncle Sam. And I think our next speaker, Ron Bailey, may have some things to say about that. But thank you for teeing that up, Ted. That was an excellent way to start off. Ron?
I'm also delighted to be here. Wonderful to talk about this particular issue. I'm kind of going to play slightly the skunk at Ted's dinner party. I've done this before. But first I'd like you to think about it. It's not a poll question. I'm not going to ask you to hold up your hand or anything, but for just a moment, I'm going to think about the following question. What is the most significant energy production technology breakthrough the last 10 years? Yes. Actually, what it is hydraulic fracking with horizontal drilling, and it was developed by Mitchell Energy over a long period of time. It was perfected in the year 2003. Why is it the most significant? Because it's added perhaps as much as 100 years of natural gas supply to the United States that we didn't have before. And by the way, the government didn't finance it, nor did philanthropy. The main point is that energy is sufficiently valuable that you're going to get people investing in this stuff all the time anyway. But moving on. The argument often you hear, though, is for new technologies, we need the government to do it because they have sufficient resources to do it, and also the time commitment to do it. That is, that they have a longer vision than private industry has, and so forth. But is that really so? Well, one of the things I'd like to do is go through some of the history, if you will, of R&D subsidies in the United States over the last 40 years, and then see what the results of those subsidies have been. Very briefly, the Department of Energy's Pacific Northwest National Lab did a report in 2008, which looked at R&D for energy from 1961 to 2008, and they found the following, that in current dollars, that added up to $187 billion, $66 billion of that went to nuclear. In other words, I should point out, you can subsidize an energy industry into existence by the government, and then you can kill it by the government, which is what we did with energy. $65 billion went to basic energy science research, the kind of things that Ted was advocating that we do, so we have done that. $28 billion went on fossil fuel research, and $28 billion on renewables and energy conservation total. Now, what about this notion of commitment, that the government alone can be committed long-term to something that's important like this? Let's go through a little history of automobile industry support, private public partnerships. Richard Nixon, one of my personally least favorite presidents, in 1970 said, and this is before the oil crisis, he did this because of pollution concerns, "I am inaugurating a program to marshal both government and private research with the goal of producing an unconventionally powered, virtually pollution-free automobile within 5 years." This meme continues to go. George H.W. Bush in 1991, at a meeting with the big three, remember when we used to have the big three automobile companies, announced jointly funded U.S. Advanced Battery Consortium, paid for by $260 million in research projects to develop a lightweight battery system for automobiles. Bill Clinton in 1993 launched the $1 billion partnership for new generation vehicles with the big three, automakers aiming to produce a car that was three times more fuel efficient than conventional cars by the year 2004. George W. Bush, not to be left out, in 2003 announced a $1.2 billion Freedom Car proposal to develop hydrogen fuel vehicles. And, of course, most recently, our current president in 2009 declared in March of 2009, I am absolutely committed to working with Congress and the auto companies to meet one goal. The United States of America will lead the world in building the next generation of clean cars. And to do that, he wants to subsidize into existence a million plug-in hybrid electric vehicles on roads by 2015 using $7,500 in tax credits per vehicle. He also provided $2.4 billion in stimulus package to jumpstart electric vehicles, $1.5 to batteries, and so forth. And then stimulus bill overall, as we now know, provided $37 billion in grants for the DOE to hand out to people for various energy projects, and $39 billion in loan guarantees. I will just say the word Solyndra here and move on. What about expert predictions? Now, people are always predicting, well, we have this much energy, we're going to do that. And one of the most fun things I ever did was that the National Academy of Sciences came out with a report last year where they were looking for the next 25 years of what America would need for energy. And I thought, well, that's great. I also remembered that in 1980, they did the same report. In 1980, they did a report called Energy in Transition, 1985 to 2010. It took 4 years to put together and 350 experts to assemble, and they were going to predict what we needed by now, 2010, in the United States. So I said, how well did they do? I decided to report to you, they did terribly. In various scenarios, most of the time they were way off on what actual economic growth was going to be, but I ticked the one that was most, the 3% annual growth one, and they concluded, for example, that up from 80 quads of energy per year the United States was using, that's 80 quadrillion British thermal units per year, we would have to be using 130 quads by now. A 60% increase. Well, what actually happened is it went up by 18 quads, so it was basically a 20% increase. We're up to 98 quads of energy. Now, among the other things they were saying, we have to have these aggressive energy conservation things. We have to mandates, and we have to make sure everything is better that way. And was that the reason why we didn't get the extra 30 quads of energy? The Resources for the Future did a report basically looking at energy efficiency mandates, and it said that it could account for, over that entire period, a reduction of 4 quads of energy, of primary energy consumption. Basically, the mandates helped very much, a little on the margin. So expert predictions, they also, in that report, said the world supplies of petroleum will be severely strained beginning in the 1980s. So the government basically had, at the time, and now we're getting to my minor role in this fiasco, under Jimmy Carter said, well, we're running out of oil, we're going to have to start synthesizing some and natural gas by turning our coal into synfuels. And so the idea was to create the Synfuels Corporation, which many of you may remember in 1980. The down payment was $20 billion on that. And as a demonstration project run by the then new Department of Energy was the Great Plains Coal Gasification Plant. I had become a federal government bureaucrat working for the world's most boring energy agency, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, in the most interesting branch, the Special Cases Branch, where I was, quote-unquote, an economist, working on the most on unconventional natural gas projects, and this was one of them. So I was, if you will, a minor league Igor to Jimmy Carter's Frankenstein with regard to this project. And I went to visit it last summer because I hadn't seen it, and I wanted to go and see. It's still there. But let me give you a little bit of the history of it. Synfuels Corporation was going to conjure into existence 22 coal gasification plants across the country. They were going to, each one of them was going to be producing 300 million cubic feet of natural gas per day. That takes about 40,000 tons of coal a day to do that. And it was a private-public partnership, 75% with loan guarantees. We've heard of those loan guarantees before recently. And 25% was put up by 5 natural gas companies. It took $2.1 billion to build it, which would be $5.5 billion today. And I'm getting there. 5 more minutes. And what happened? Natural gas, this is a good thing that Jimmy Carter did. He deregulated natural gas. It turned out we were not having a natural gas shortage. We were having a shortage of government-priced natural gas. And so what happens is that we didn't need to have this coal gasification plant in the first place. So the good news is that we didn't build a plant. This particular plant was sold for 4 cents on the dollar to a local utility. 4 cents on the dollar. And I visited it, and they're making a slight profit on it today, but by making fertilizer and other byproducts, not the natural gas. If your capital costs are paid for, you can make money out of one of these things. And one of my favorite lines that comes from DOE, Office of Clean Energy Collaboration, John Panik said, and I quote, technologically, it's always been a success. Technologically, it's always been a success, but it has always been a victim of the marketplace. Anyway, crony capitalism may have been invented when the electric power industry was created in the United States. A fascinating story about this. The reason the electric power industry is, in my opinion, the least innovative industry in America is because it's the most regulated industry in America, and that has always been a problem. Think of the history of regulation of electric power. What happened is that for the first 30 years of electric power, it was regulated by municipalities. Then in 1907, New York State and Wisconsin said, we're going to create state commissions because we've got to get control of this. You know, it's a public interest to do this. It was a progressive thing. And so why did they do that? It turned out that what had happened, if you look at the history, is that the electric power companies in those states had engaged in such ruinous competition that they really needed the government to come in and sort things out and make the market rational. And so when they did that, an economist named Greg Jarrell has looked at this, and what happened is the first states that did this turned out to be a total story of regulatory capture, is that the states that adopted regulation early had an average 45% lower electric rates, 30% lower profits, and 25% greater productivity. But we had to regulate it to get rid of ruinous competition. What about the green jobs thing here? Hillier Huntington at Stanford Energy Modeling Forum, for example, in a 2009 report, looked at if you invest $1 million in a green job, you can produce 3 to 5 solar, 2 to 6 wind, 2 to 6 biomass, 4 coal, 2 in natural gas. But his point is, he points out, $1 million invested almost anywhere else in the economy produces 10 jobs. So basically by doing that, you're destroying 7 jobs if you do solar, 8 jobs if you do wind, coal, 6 jobs, biomass, 8 jobs, and natural gas. Basically, if you want to invest in producing jobs, don't invest in energy. If that's what you want to do, produce jobs. I will skip over the climate change negotiations and hope someone will ask me about that. The question I'm going to come to is, so what should you do as representatives of the philanthropic community here? To a first approximation, I would suggest that you do nothing. That this is a field that is already so meddled with and so rife with conflicts and so forth in crony capitalism, there's almost nothing you could do, at least in the domestic economy. What you could do, on the other hand, is invest in the kinds of things that will create the resilience that Ted is talking about, that will make people able to weather, if you will, the weather, and so forth. So basically, create wealth. Invest in things that create wealth for poor people. That's the way to go. If you want to handle climate change or any weather thing, do it that way. So off the top of my head, spend more money on women's literacy programs, clean water, work on water privatization, vaccinations, agriculture, biotechnology, the rule of law. If you want to meddle with this a little bit, one model you might consider doing was just announced this week, was Peter Thiel has come up with something called the Breakout Labs, where basically he's going to be investing private money in radical technologies, things that the government wouldn't consider doing because it's way too weird. And maybe that might work if you have a little bit of money to do that. Anyway, the final thing I'd like to leave you with is, after a long time of thinking about this, ultimately I think that is probably the case that what government is likely to do about climate change is probably going to be worse than what climate change would do to us. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ron. All right, well, you left us with some things for the later discussion. Our last speaker is Robert Bryce, and one thing I like about Robert that I didn't mention in the introduction is that, you know, he has a slight similarity to Jack Webb of Dragnet fame, and he is, in fact, a just-the-facts-ma'am kind of guy. Robert approaches this from a quantitative, mathematical, fact perspective. Give us the facts, Rob.
All right, thank you. 4 points. scale, hotter or colder, wind and CO2, and then to follow on Ron's point, what is the role, if there is one, for philanthropic efforts? Okay, so first, lesson and scale. Pop quiz, I hope you studied. Name the country which over the last decade has had the biggest percentage increase in CO2 emissions. Anyone? China's not a bad guess. It's not right. India's not a bad guess. Vietnam. Which country over the last 10 years has had the biggest percentage increase in coal consumption? Vietnam. Which country has had the biggest percentage increase in electricity generation?
Vietnam.
It's early, but I'm glad you're catching on. Good. The case of Vietnam, along with many of the numbers that Ted just discussed, are a reason why I am convinced that there will be no, and has been no, agreement on any global carbon tax, carbon limits. I had a piece in the Wall Street Journal a few weeks ago, which I said this very thing. The piece was called Five Truths About Climate Change. And my first point was the carbon taxers, limiters, have lost. Why have they lost? Because of countries like Vietnam, because of countries like Malaysia, South Korea, Indonesia, Brazil, Pakistan, all these countries that are dramatically increasing their energy consumption. Why? Well, many of the reasons that Ted outlined. I'm not arguing the science one way or another. I'm an agnostic, okay? Tell me CO2 is good, tell me it's bad, I don't care. If you believe CO2 is bad, the point is, then what? If CO2 is bad, then what? What is your solution? And the reality is that, as Ted pointed out, growth trumps concern for the climate. The problem is the tyranny of big numbers. This is a math and physics issue. It's where it's infused all along with religious discussions about faith in CO2 or absence of faith. And if you're a heretic or a skeptic, you're branded as an outlier and, of course, in the pocket of Coke or Exxon or whoever. Those charges have been made, of course, against me. But here's the tyranny of big numbers. On an average day, the global population, 7 billion people now, we consume 241 million barrels of oil equivalent per day of primary energy. That's all commercial transactions, all sources, nuclear, hydro, coal, oil, natural gas, etc. How do we typify that? It's 29 Saudi Arabias. Since 1970, the Saudis have been producing an average of 8.2 million barrels of oil per day. So we consume, as a global population, 29 Saudi Arabias per day. It's a power figure. The per number is the key one there. But of that, we get 25 Saudi Arabias from hydrocarbons. 210 million barrels of oil equivalent per day come from coal, oil, and natural gas. We can say CO2 is good. We can say it's bad. The reality is hydrocarbons are here to stay. Hydrocarbons provide 9 out of 10 units of energy, 9 out of 10 units of power that we consume. And energy transitions take decades or even centuries, not years. So the punchline is very obvious, I believe, and that is that these efforts to tax or limit carbon dioxide have failed. Over the last decade, this was the issue. This was the environmental issue of the last decade. What to do about CO2 limits? Al Gore won the Academy Award, won a Nobel Prize, won an Emmy. We had the meetings in Copenhagen. We had meetings in Cancun, etc. Two IPCC reports. What happened? Global CO2 emissions rose by 28.5%. Over that same time period, global energy consumption increased by 51 million barrels of oil equivalent per day. That's 6 Saudi Arabias. Meanwhile, in the U.S., CO2 emissions fell by 1.7%. Put another way, over the last decade, U.S. CO2 emissions could have gone to zero, and global CO2 emissions still would have gone up. Let me give you a quick just rundown on the numbers. The increase in CO2 emissions, top five over the last decade, Vietnam up 137%, China is second, 123%, Qatar 115%, Trinidad 84%, India 78%. Nominal increases, it's clearly China, increase of 4.6 billion tons, India 748 million, Saudi Arabia 220 million tons, Iran 212 million tons, and then fifth, South Korea 174 million tons. Those five countries alone accounted for 80% of the increase in nominal increase in CO2 emissions over the last decade. Ron mentioned Solyndra. I'm all for solar. I'm hopeful for solar. I think solar, I'm much more hopeful for solar than I am for wind for a lot of reasons, and I'll talk about those in just a moment. I have solar panels on the roof of my house, 3,200 watts. Why? Because the city of Austin, where I live, gave me a 2/3 subsidy. So just to be clear, I'm not opposed to subsidies if they're coming to me. But what about solar? Again, this is an issue of scale and the tyranny of numbers. Well, it boggles my mind why the Obama administration is spending so much time and taking now what is incredible political heat for the Solyndra deal on a raw energy delivered basis. Hydrocarbons in the United States provide 21,000 times more energy as solar. If you haircut that 21,000 times by 2/3 to account for the thermodynamic losses in the conversion of coal, oil, or natural gas to electricity, we're still at 7,000 times. Second point, if the climate is changing, whether it is getting hotter or colder or both, we're going to have to produce a lot more energy. That, to me, that fact is so obvious, we shouldn't even be repeating it, but I am repeating it, because we don't hear that often enough. If it is, in fact, getting hotter or colder or both, and it may well be, we're going to have to produce a lot more energy. Even if the climate stays exactly the same as it has been, over the last 10 years, energy consumption has grown by 27%. We need a lot more energy, and it's a lot of that energy is going to be coming from hydrocarbons. What was the fastest growing form of fuel use over the last decade? It was coal, up by 47%. Why? Because electric demand is growing at unbelievable rates around the world. The essentiality of electricity to modernity is incontrovertible. The countries that can produce cheap, abundant, reliable electricity are the ones that can come into the modern world and prosper, and the ones that can't, can't. Africa is the dark continent. Why? It's dark. 33 million Canadians use as much electricity as a billion Africans. Love Bono, love you too. Somebody needs to give him a bunch of big generators to take with him when he goes over to Africa. That's what Africa needs. Third point, wind energy is far too costly and requires far too much land to be an effective method of CO2 reduction. I did a report on this for Manhattan Institute just about 10 days ago. It's easily available. You can look at my website on Manhattan Institute's website. Here's the punchline. We've heard over and over we should be getting 20% of U.S. electricity from wind by 2030. Okay? Well, I used Department of Energy numbers. What would it cost? It would cost $850 billion, and it would require a land area roughly the size of South Dakota. That's if we did it all on land. If you do it offshore, double that number, $1.7 trillion. And what would the result be? A CO2 reduction of 2%. A CO2 reduction of global emissions by 2% by 2030. Ted advocated a $4 to $6 carbon tax. The numbers I just gave you imply then if we spent that $850 billion, a carbon tax of roughly $50 per ton. The RGGI credits in the East Coast in the U.S. are now selling for $1.89. Add in to the wind issue the backlash against industrial wind that is global. I just looked at these numbers this morning. You can look it up yourself. EPAW.org, EPAW.org, the European Platform Against Wind Farms, has 504 signatory organizations in 23 European countries. The UK alone has 250 anti-wind groups. Ontario, Canada, more than 50. The US, about 170. The backlash against industrial wind is global. It is growing. And I've interviewed people all over the world who have been subjected to these industrial wind farms being put within, in some cases, several thousand feet of their homes. In fact, I just interviewed a man just in the last few days named Dave Enns. He and his wife in Denmark, Wisconsin, were forced out of their home by the low frequency noise coming from a wind turbine that was put up 3,000 feet from their home. I can cite you numerous examples of this all around the world, and the wind industry has no solution for it. This furor over hydraulic fracturing, in my view, is much ado about nothing. Meanwhile, the wind industry is getting away with, in fact, murder on this very issue, and they claim that the people who are complaining just need psychological counseling. I'm not kidding. So what's the role for philanthropy? Well, briefly, to add to Ron's points, the shale revolution we're only in the beginning of understanding what this means for cheap, abundant, reliable energy availability here in the United States and around the world. It is truly a revolution. It's the most important development in the global energy sector since the discovery of the East Texas field in 1930. The latest analysis by Bentech Energy estimates U.S. oil production from shale oil, we talked about shale gas, could be 2 million barrels a day of increase in the next 5 years. The U.S. oil production, domestic oil production, could soon eclipse the levels we achieved in the early 1970s. What's happening? Well, it's innovation. It's innovation that is happening in old line industries. There's this bias that the developments in all these new technologies will happen in green tech, clean tech batteries, all the while ignoring that the U.S. oil and gas upstream spends $150 billion a year. They have tremendous incentive to innovate. Okay, so what can philanthropic efforts do, philanthropic groups? I think one area is clean cook stoves. I mean, this is an incredibly important area. You can ally with the Global Alliance for Clean Cook Stoves. They estimate that 1.9 million premature deaths occur every year, most of them among women and children, particularly girls, because of indoor air pollution caused by inefficient cook stoves. Replace those inefficient cook stoves with more efficient cook stoves. You have several benefits. A dramatic reduction in CO2 emissions of about a ton and a half of carbon dioxide per stove installed. And a dramatic reduction in black carbon soot. This is a key issue. About a third of all the black carbon emissions on the planet come from inefficient cook stoves. And the role of this soot, one study has estimated that the black carbon deposits may be causing more Arctic climate change than all other man-made causes combined. So the issue of getting this amount of soot down, improving indoor air pollution would have multiple benefits that go beyond just the question of CO2. The other places for philanthropy, look at the work being done by Medic Mobile, a company or a startup NGO. They're using cell phones to help improve health delivery in rural areas. They're working in 10 different countries in Africa, Asia, and in Latin America. But the punchline is here, anything that philanthropic organizations can do to increase the availability of energy and power among the world's poor is a net positive. Why? Because the latest IEA numbers, they just came out with a report in the last 10 days on eradicating energy poverty. We have 1.3 billion people around the planet still living without electricity. 2.4 billion people still cooking with traditional biomass. Dung, wheat straw, twigs, you name it. The only way we are going to bring those people into the modern world is with modern, efficient energy and power systems. And for many of these people, even minute quantities by our measures of modern energy and power systems can have a dramatic effect on the quality of their lives. Thank you.
Thank you, Robert. We've got a little less than 25 minutes left, and we're going to go to the audience very quickly. But just a couple of quick things up here first. Robert, when you have occasion to speak directly with policymakers and with pundits, say, from what you would perceive as the other side, how do they respond to the quantitative facts, which to me sound largely unarguable, when you present them to them?
Well, the response I've been getting lately is that I work for big oil. I mean, it's not the... And Ted and I talked about this last night, and it's something that... I work extremely hard to talk about math and physics, but for large segments of the population, and Ron knows this very well, this is a religious discussion. So if you can't counter the argument, you attack the person. One of my favorite lines is a friend of mine went to law school, and the thing that he learned in law school was a law prof told him, if you have the facts, pound the facts. Have the law, pound the law. If you don't have the facts or the law, pound the table.
Right.
And so what
Jimmy
we get
Stewart.
More than anything is a lot of table pounding.
Any comment on that from you guys? Okay.
Okay.
All right. Ron, we're hoping that someone would ask about the climate change negotiations, and after you comment on that, I'd like to have a little bit of engagement with you and Ted on the subsidies question and the distinction between an engineering project on the one hand, such as the Manhattan Project, the moon landing, and a research project on the other hand.
Sure.
The climate change negotiations.
Very, very briefly, I have attended 7, and I'll be going to my 8th one soon. I was at, watched this process go on and on and on. I have to say I like it because generally, I like going to cover because generally the bureaucrats pick nice places. I've been to Bali. My Christmas shopping in Bali was great. But they are not, and by the way, if they decided to create the UN Directorate for Climate Change in Bali, I would be happy to become a permanent reporter there. But basically, I watched Copenhagen come. It was, the collapse was amazing. Finally, some news because they couldn't even paper it over at that time. And then you go to Cancun and the bureaucrats are frightened. They can see, oh my gosh, this whole thing is falling apart. So they cobble together something which basically, if you look at it, was vacuous. And I'm fully expecting the Durban thing to completely fall apart. I could be wrong, but they only have one more year left. And I don't think anything's going to come out of it. And it's largely for the reasons that Robert has outlined. There are no countries that are going to whack their economy in order to solve a problem that's a 100-year problem. And as Ted pointed out, real intergenerational equity is the following. Would you have wanted your grandparents to sacrifice, how much would you want them to sacrifice their burning of coal, oil, and so forth in order for you to have a climate that was 1 degree colder than it is now? Then these people had an eighth of your income. So this is why we're basically asking people now on planet Earth, $8,000 a year is the average income on planet Earth currently, and people in the year 2100 are going to have at least $80,000 a year. So how much should we be sacrificing for them? And that's the right question.
Ron, can I ask you, well, you said there's only one more year. Is that
the Kyoto process? Oh, I'm sorry.
Kyoto expires.
Kyoto expires in 2012.
Oh, okay.
That's what I mean.
If they don't agree in Durban, then there's no agreement at all going forward.
I would think not. It would be almost impossible for them to cobble that together.
But have they acknowledged that Kyoto itself was a failure? That would be a no. How many countries actually met their Kyoto targets?
Very few.
Well, it depends how you.
How you fudge the numbers.
I mean, the EU will probably meet their Kyoto targets because they negotiated very savvily in setting the beginning of the baseline against which the targets would start in 1990. The treaty wasn't signed until 97. In the years that intervened, German reunification, East German economy collapsed, East Germany decommissioned a huge amount of super dirty, inefficient coal power that was powering very inefficient industries that shut down. So Germany had a huge decline in its emissions having nothing to do with its climate commitments. And similarly, the UK, for multiple reasons, had largely moved from coal to gas. So by 97, because of the UK and Germany, the EU 15, the 15 core members of the EU are already well below their target, and actually their emissions since 97 have just been rising. So they will technically comply with their treaty obligations, even though they've done nothing.
Okay. And it didn't hurt that we had the economic collapse in the last few years. That helped.
Yeah.
Right.
But there's no evidence that climate policy has had any impact on the trajectory of carbon emissions anywhere in the world.
Well, if I can just add one quick point, and that I mentioned this in the piece I had in the journal just a few weeks ago, that in fact the U.S., because of shale gas, is now effectively decarbonizing more quickly than is Europe. And this is not my view. This has been, well, Ted has the numbers on this as well, but this is from an interview I did with at the International Energy Agency in Paris, talking to the head of their power markets division. He said, right now, in fact, Europe is adding more coal-fired generation capacity on a grid relative basis than is the United States. And the U.S. is reducing its CO2 emissions quicker than Europe is, even though Europe has set up this emission trading scheme and carbon taxation and so on and so forth. So this shale revolution, you know, is just unqualified good news on about 10 different levels.
But the point is that we're doing that not because of carbon dioxide, we're doing it because gas is cheap.
Right, and that was Laszlo Varro's point, was that the economic driver of cheap gas has been far more effective in the United States than any kind of regulatory system that had been set up in Europe.
Exactly.
One question for you, Ted, before we go to the audience. I mentioned earlier that your perspective has evolved on these issues of climate and energy. I really don't know the details there, so I hope I'm not putting you on the spot, but would you like to briefly tell us how does your perspective today differ than what it was, say, 10 years ago in terms of your view of the state of this issue and what needs to be done?
Yeah, I would say three things. I think I've become less apocalyptic about the risks. I was telling Jerry last night, though, that I think there are still some catastrophic scenarios, particularly with melting of permafrost, release of methane. I think the kind of scenarios that potentially are catastrophic is when you're looking at rapid climate change on decadal timescales rather than century timescales. If you have over 200 years, we can probably adapt to most of this. If you're looking at, you know, rapid climate change, sea level rise, things like that over 20, 30 years, you probably have a problem. And there are some potential scenarios where you kind of get runaway climate change. So that is the really, that is the one kind of thing that you look at and can still kind of get yourself pretty apocalyptic about. I think, have had a real education in Robert's math, just the reality of the low carbon alternatives today, particularly solar, wind, batteries, very problematic. That in turn has led to perhaps the most prominent and biggest change, which is I've become sort of strongly pro-nuclear, and I would suggest that that if you're not pro-nuclear, you're not really an environmentalist, and that the corollary to this is that if you are pro-nuclear, you are not a libertarian.
The reason being?
Because there is just no way you get that technology or can scale it or manage it without a substantial involvement of government.
Ron?
I respectfully disagree. There are some technologies out there at the far edge that might not need much government regulation, such as traveling wave reactors, that kind of thing, that are being developed by people. But that's a longer-term thing. But those are basically proliferation-proof. You don't have much waste to manage or anything else like that. So there are nuclear technologies in train that would not require much government regulation.
I think that wouldn't require government regulation, but I think it's pretty clear that to actually sort of develop those technologies and even begin to commercialize them, there's going to be a substantial public role in that.
There will be more of this in the hall outside, but final words from Robert.
Cheap, abundant, reliable. Cheap, abundant, reliable. Cheap, abundant, reliable. That's what energy policy should fundamentally be about here in the United States and around the world. And if you all can help make that happen, I applaud you.
Thank you all, panel, and thank you, audience.